Hello, everybody. My name is Daisy, and I'm a recovering compulsive overeater, bulimic. And it's amazing to see how many people are on today. God, 69. It'd be lovely to be in the same room together, but I feel very blessed by this incredible international community and ability to be anywhere and connect with the program. It certainly makes my recovery feel safer, even though sometimes I'm really in need of a face-to-face meeting, because a particular aspect of this disease for me is the aspect of hiding and the aspect of not wanting to be seen and secrecy. And I was always told when I first came to recovery that we are sick as our secrets. Anyway, I'll give you a little bit of background. I'm British, as you with quite a lot of sprinkles of other things, as you can probably hear from my accent. I live in London now, but and I grew up. I had parents who were divorced very early. Shouldn't have never have got married, probably. My mother is a compulsive overeater. My grandmother was a compulsive overeater. And from a very young age, I was terrified of this grandmother, who also had quite a temper on her. And I kind of had an inner vow from a very early age, I never wanted to be like her. And I saw it. I saw her size as the sort of as the terror, as the problem, rather than what was actually behind it. And so much of my recovery or my disease was looking at the outsides, but not, and looking at the, what I looked like, what other people looked like, comparing despair, but not recognizing that it's what's underneath, and it's the feelings that are the source and the path to recovery. And I started my first kind of restriction on food. I wouldn't call it a diet, but it was my first awareness that I should stop eating certain things at the age of 7. And I was a very sporty, tomboyish kind of kid, and very competitive, always wanting to be the best, always wanting to be the center of attention. And underneath that, I think it masked actually a shyness. I think it masked. It was my way of dealing with, I'm not quite sure how to deal with a school playground. I'm not sure how to get a friend. I'm not sure how to deal with the work. I'm not sure how to be in the world, really. And my first sort of difficulty in my life, parents divorced, my mother left, and very unusually for those days, I was left growing up with my father, and we were brought up by him and a Spanish help in the house, Spanish nanny. And everything in all my families that I was with, it was always about food. My parents and grandparents were war people. They'd been in a war, they'd had a lot of difficulty and starvation. So you were never allowed to not eat everything on your plate. And that wasn't a problem for me, because I wanted to eat everything. And that continued, and I didn't have many consequences in terms of my weight being extreme until my teens. And when I was in my teens, the weight started to pile on, and I became more self-conscious and aware. But I wasn't compulsively overeating. I was eating a lot, but not compulsively overeating. And of course, I was eating the sweet things and all the rest of it. But when I was 18 and I went to college, to university, an event happened in our family, which I won't go into now because I want to really talk about more recovery than about the illness. But I will, qualify my step one by saying that this event was like a night and day for my illness. And I started compulsive overeating, and I started bulimia in a week, in my first week of going to university. And I could not stop. I could not stop. I could not stop binging all day. And I'm part of a family of five. And when I say in binging, my mother, we'd have food enough for five kids, plus the parents, in the house. And I couldn't stop. And it wasn't just the food that I couldn't stop eating. I couldn't stop eating. There was the behaviors beside it. There was, I had a boyfriend, and every time he left the house, I would start binging. And every day I would vow I would stop. And every day there would be this effort to try and not eat, because I knew the minute I started, I would carry on. Or I would go out to the house to hide it, and I would run up and down the streets. And I would walk a lot, because that's part of the bulimic and the restricting. I'd started dieting before this event. I'd already started dieting before that, and it was a way I could connect with my mother, which was a very difficult relationship. The disease escalates. There's no doubt about that. The disease escalates, and the behaviors and the self-hatred and the guilt and the low self-esteem escalated exponentially alongside it. But more worrying under that, because I was a great one for wanting to have the outsides look good. I had whole ideas about what my career was going to be and how successful that was going to be and what kind of boyfriend and what kind of this and that and the other. But as the lack of control happened, as I had less and less ability to stop myself, my real fear was there. My real fear was there was kind of exposed. And the more that that fear and that self-doubt happened, that I couldn't stop eating every day, and I couldn't stop the bulimia, and the bulimia was not easy for me. I found it really hard to kind of purge, and I found it really, I resorted to more and more dangerous means to do so, and it wasted more and more time of my life. And I had to compensate more and more. And as that happened, and I did things that I would never do, I started to steal. I was sharing apartments with people and I stole their stuff. I started to, I would say no to an event if I had started the binge that day, and I'd make up lies and excuses for not turning up, or I would turn up, look like I was kind of doing okay at the mealtime, and then immediately go off and binge afterwards. What would happen towards the end was that even that kind of, trying to look okay on the outside went away, kind of just disappeared. And I was reaching out onto the next door table at a restaurant and taking some stranger's leftovers. Or I would, I was shoplifting by then. I had to leave my first most wonderful job because I couldn't stop eating, at the office and purging. And I had to leave just before I was fired. So the consequences were big, even bigger. I left the country in England because I was fired, and I ruined a career because it was this kind of niche, a niche place that, not a niche place, what I'm talking about, a niche, yeah, sort of a niche kind of career place where people knew each other in the industry. And I had kind of burnt all my bridges, and I couldn't be referred. And so I ran away. I did a geographical, I went to the States. And there I found my first meetings. I found the fellowship. And it was great to have a place where I found other people who were doing the same as me, where I could actually be honest for the first time, where I could actually say what I was doing and have identification. And I started that, a place where I kind of got a day's abstinence. And then the next day I would blow it. And then a day's abstinence, and then the next day I'd blow it. And it started, I think, the process of about, and by this time I'd also, I was involved with a man who was like 23 years older than me, and I was, you know, the outsides, although I could pretend to those people, my family in England, it was all wonderful, and I'd gone to the States, it wasn't all wonderful. I was very lonely. I loved the fellowship, but I wasn't getting totally abstinent. I had a place, and I would try the, you know, the suggestions, but I wasn't entirely giving in to everything in the program. I started to get really good at learning about the steps, but I hadn't completely got my abstinence, and you know, in a continuous way. And I would go to a meeting, and then I would binge after the meeting, or I'd binge on the way to the meeting, and then I'd purge on the way out back home. And there was this part of me that was really losing hope inside, and was really frightened. And as soon as I had that feeling of fear, I would numb it with the food, because that was a great way not to feel the feelings. And I got to a place where I thought I was one of those poor unfortunates that they have in the AA Big Book, which, you know, who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And I would get, you know, maybe, you know, a little bit of abstinence and then blow it. And then, you know, I had a sponsor, and I had, you know, all I seemed like I was doing the work. But there's something inside of me that still hadn't completely given in. And I wanted something, I began to want something that seemed impossible, but I was willing to go to any lengths to get it. And that was, I wanted something which was continuous abstinence. I wanted to know what it was like to live beyond the food, to know what it was like to stop thinking about, you know, the first step, and actually be able to truly get on to the rest of the steps without having the anchor of that self-disgust and feeling of failure and feeling I'll never get it. And I went back to England for Christmas for my family one year, and I met a friend who, a childhood friend who had always been kind of overweight and mean, and we great friends, and she looked different. And it wasn't that she'd lost some weight, it was that her eyes were sparkly. And I said, "What have you done?" And she said, "Oh, you know what? I went to a treatment center. I finally went to a treatment, and I gave in on my problem. And I said, I've got to do this. I've got to give in. I've got to surrender and let someone else really tell me and let go for everything else that I want in my life, like the Greek career or the great boyfriend or the great relationship or the big I am. I've got to let go completely and put this first." And I did. And it was the toughest thing in my life, because by then I was in the program. I knew all the words, but I hadn't got the actual actions underpinning me and underpinning my words. I got all the right, you know, I could quote you the different steps and the, you know, different parts of the books, and I could, you know, I knew what to do. I knew all the nine tools of the this, that, and the other, but I hadn't got so I've lost where the clock is. I lost the real ability to surrender and to listen and to really, and as I said, put this first. And it was the beginning of it's the beginning of my true abstinence. My abstinence is, and what I learned was that my abstinence is that I don't eat sugar and white flour. I eat three meals a day. And I made my abstinence, which someone suggested, loose, so that I wouldn't set myself up for a feeling of failure if I'd eaten one more pea than I thought I should eat on my plate or something. I'm sorry if I'm talking about food here, but it's, hey, it's my chair today, I suppose. And this is what I did. And my abstinence was that I would never throw up or do any kind of bulimic behavior. I stopped my overexercising, and I re reduced it to three times or two times a week, which I do. I three meals a day, except nothing in between. Except if I'm flying transatlantic, I might eat a second. And that has stood me in great stead for the last 35 years. a day at a time. And I was able to start stopping thinking about calories, stop looking at
5 minutes
other
remain.
people. Thank you. Stop eating, looking at magazines or calories or whatever it was, and start looking at the steps, seeing the insanity of my behavior, seeing starting to look at a higher power, which I really have, a great relationship, a conscious contact with today. Doing the step four, looking at what was underneath that, looking, but always the one thing that helped me every single day to start with was the importance of really feeling my feelings. Every time I wanted to eat or I was angry, was I'd really stop and feel those feelings, and the feeling of wanting to eat would go away. I'd share it, call someone up, go to a meeting, have a sponsor. I have a great sponsor. I've had this for the same sponsor for the last 35 years, and have sponsees do service. My step four and five was an actual exercise in beat. My first one was an exercise in beating myself up. My step six was really an indulgence in how to kind of wallow in how awful I was. It's taken a long time to forgive myself and to feel okay in my skin. And it's taken more than just going to the meetings. I've done outside work, and it's which has been really helpful. Step seven, was it's step six and seven are probably the crux of the program, because it's the stuff underneath the food that is really what's always held me back. And when I'd done that, and I don't see the steps, they are linear at one level, but I always have to go back to step six and seven, in a day or within a week or within a month, because there's always something that pops up. And what used to be a problem 30 years ago is not necessarily the problem now, or something's come back after sort of 10 years or whatever it is. And I've been able to do what I wanted to do. I got married. I've got kids in being pregnant. I've had cancer. I've dealt with the death of a parent in OA. All these things, and happy things, without overeating, without being bulimic a day at a time. And steps eight and nine. Step eight for me was not just writing the list of the people I needed to, make amends to, but also, how am I going to make those amends? I had that compulsive overeater grandmother I couldn't stand, and I had done a terrible, for me, terrible thing on the deathbed of her husband, my grandfather, who I adored. And I had made this scene of when he was dying all about me, and had brought the attention onto me. I was right in my illness at that point. And I flew back for my amends. I flew back to France, where she was living alone and very lonely, just to help her. Just to kind of do some things that my grandfather would have done for her and that she couldn't no longer do. And I made amends to my grandfather who had passed, and that was very moving. So there are many different types. There are ongoing amends to my kids, to my still living mother, to people, and to myself. And step 10, sometimes I do the nightly written thing, sometimes I don't. And right now, I call my sponsor once a week, and we talk about our step tens and what's going on in our lives once a week. And she's been someone, who has been incredible in my life. She's sort of like a sort of soul sister, I suppose. And I'm very, very, very fortunate. 11 and 12, probably the most important. 11, my conscious con a few years ago, I started to really spend the time to take some conscious contact, to make conscious contact with a God of my understanding. And that took what I've just said, the word time, for me. And I just waited until I and was patient, which is not my natural disposition with myself. And oops, I see that seconds are running away. And step 12 is not just about passing on the message. It's about practicing these principles in all my affairs. You know what? I'm totally imperfect. Sometimes I get it and sometimes I don't. And I think I'll just end there. Thank you very much.